This is the BBC.
Thanks for downloading this episode of In Our Time. There's a reading list to go with it on our website, and you can get news about our programmes if you follow us on Twitter at BBC In Our Time. I hope you enjoyed the programmes. Hello. In 63 BC, Marcus Tullius Cicero was elected as one of the two consuls in Rome, the highest political position, a remarkable rise for someone born outside the establishment. One of his goals was to stabilize the Republic, which was under threat from armed conspirators, aristocrats who claimed to be men of the people, and generals who would be tyrants. He suppressed a revolt to great acclaim, executing the ringleaders without trial, only to be exiled for this act once their supporters were in power. Exile gave him time to develop his ideas about the form the Republic should take if it were to survive, how the powers would be balanced within it, how to reconcile duty with self-interest, and how to deal with tyrants, the true enemies, as he saw it, of the people. With me to discuss Cicero's life and political philosophy are Melissa Lane, the class of 1943 Professor of Politics at Princeton University, Catherine Steele, Professor of Classics at the University of Glasgow, and Valentina Arena, Reader in Roman History at University College London. Melissa Lane, what was Cicero's background?
Cicero came from a town outside Rome that had only recently been given the privileges of full citizenship. So he was a noas homo, he was a new man. His family hadn't had historically political power or political office in Rome, so he really had to make his way on his own merits.
But what did his family have? They were wealthy enough. Can you give us a bit more than that, please?
Yeah, they were wealthy enough to be able to give him a good education, to support his desire to study first philosophy in Athens and then to move to Rome. But they didn't have the history, the legacy. They didn't have the patrician standing that would have made his path in politics easier.
They didn't have the network in Rome is what mattered, didn't they?
Yeah, not to that extent.
Interesting they went to Greece, isn't it? They're going back to Greece to learn. It's fascinating. It is.
It was a thing that some ambitious and intellectually ambitious young Romans wanted to do. And Cicero traveled throughout Greece. He studied in Athens but went elsewhere to meet leading philosophers in Rhodes and in other places. And he later sent his son to do the same.
In Athens, would he have been in some sort of contact? I know they're all dead. I'm not talking about anything spooky. In some sort of contact with the great Greeks we're very often talking about on this program.
Yes, so he studies all the schools of Hellenistic philosophy that were alive at the time and with some of their great figures, so the Stoics, the Epicureans. His own allegiance was more to the Skeptics, so he took the view that you could support whatever argument seemed most plausible. But of course, he became a great admirer of Plato, and his political works are very much written in dialogue with Plato.
So he got cracking, learned a lot there, and then he, as I said in the introduction, by the age of 42, which was young at the time, born the youngest ever, he became a consul, one of the two consuls in Rome. How did he get there so quickly?
So he had to climb the ladder, as it were, run the course of offices, of honors, which was a series of elections. They weren't elections quite as we know them. They're first past the post, but by groups of classes organized by wealth. So there's a different structure to Roman elections. But what really made his name actually was a legal prosecution that he brought in the year 70 against a former governor of Sicily who was being accused of extortion, bribery, murder, corruption on a vast scale. And Cicero prosecuted this man. He went to Sicily, where he had previously served in a lower office, collected amazing trunks and depositions of evidence, came back and won the case against Rome's greatest advocate at the time. And that was really the moment that he stepped out from the ranks of strivers and became someone to be reckoned with.
Winning is rather a mild word. He was so strong that the chap Verres fled the city
before the end of the trial. No, that's right.
And Cicero,
right.
Being Cicero and vain of what he'd done, still published all that he was going to say had the man stayed there.
That's right.
I like that bit. But that set him off. So you set off as a lawyer, a very successful lawyer. Why was that city so intrigued and pleased by someone who came up through the law?
Well, the law was the place where you could speak in public. So the prosecutions, the courts were held in public so the citizens could attend. And it was a chance to really make your oratorical powers felt. You know, it was really a gladiatorial duel of a kind. And so he was able through that both to impress some of the leading men in the Senate, but also to win favor among the people.
Catherine Steele, we come on the Catalan conspiracy soon after that. What was the Catalan conspiracy and how did it come to be a conspiracy?
Well, one of the difficulties in getting to grips with the Catalanarian conspiracy is that much of our initial evidence for it comes from Cicero, who of course had suppressed it and therefore has a very particular story to tell about the wickedness of Catalan and the extent to which this is a threat to the Republic.
Can you give us a bit about Catalan, please?
Catalan was a patrician politician. Like Cicero, he was aspiring to highest office, but he failed to get there. And one of the origins of the conspiracy seems to have been his failure to be elected as consul and looking there for to widen his support base with a view to a second attempt on the consulship, and when that failed in the summer of 63, that seems to be the point at which he explored other routes to power.
Like killing all the Senate.
Well, that's one of the things that Cicero said he was planning to do. Certainly there's more substantial evidence of a military uprising in Etruria and to use military force in order to acquire power in Rome. And that was what Cicero was trying to warn the Senate was the danger and eventually convinced them was the danger, and then a process was set in motion which ended both in military action but also the deaths of some of Catiline's co-conspirators.
The way in which he got to know shows that he was a man who had enormous contacts and networks of power. He kept being tipped off, didn't he?
He did, yes. He kept talking about the information that had been given to him about the conspiracy, and the trigger for the famous debate in which the decision to execute Catiline's co-conspirators was taken was being tipped off that they were in negotiation with a Gallic tribe. And then Cicero was able to catch them red-handed with letters which indicated the scope of those negotiations.
It shows him being very proactive or somebody that people wanted to curry favour with and be on the side of. Which was it?
Well, I think it's a bit of both.
Right. Always is, isn't it, when you ask a question like that?
Yes. I mean, he's developing his networks, but because he's consul, he has things to offer people who bring him information.
Yes. But he got key information at key times. With a day or two to go, he had it, and he talked him out, as it were, inside the Senate and so on, didn't he?
Yes, because then he was able to set up this dramatic revealing of the evidence. In which the conspirators were brought in with the letters still unsealed. So he took the gamble that they would contain what he thought those letters would contain. And then they're opened in the Senate, and they do. And he can take things forward on that basis.
So he suppressed this conspiracy. Some of the conspirators had another go, and he rounded them up. He had them executed, but he did not give them a trial. But nevertheless, when he executed them and cleared the decks of the conspirators, he was lauded in Rome, wasn't he?
At the time, yes. And, well, again, we're dependent on Cicero for the accounts, but the being escorted back home by the torchlight procession, being acclaimed in the Senate as Pater Patriae, father of his fatherland. And, of course, one of the reasons that Cicero was so pleased about all of this was that his career had been entirely civilian. And Rome was a society in which some of the highest rewards tended to be restricted to those who had been militarily victorious. So as a civilian consul who nonetheless saved the res publica, that was tremendously exciting as a basis for further reputation. But of course it does all go horribly wrong for him.
Yes, we can come to that in a moment, but you prepared us for it going horribly wrong. But at that time he was at a fair height of his powers, wasn't he? It was an extraordinary rise. We mustn't gloss over this because he gets to be more and more important, but being that important and that influential and that effective, that young in those terms, was terrific.
Well, yes, and I think Melissa has already pointed to the way that Cicero built his career through effective oratory in order to put together a coalition of supporters. There's the possibly spurious Commentariolum Petitionis, the commentary, little book about electioneering, which may be written by his brother, it may not be, but it seems to capture the advice to give Cicero that in order to be elected as consul, which was this huge challenge for somebody without the political and historical background at Rome, he needed to appeal to as broad a possible an audience. And we can see in Cicero's oratory up until the consulship the great care not to offend anybody. So, and indeed early in 63 he claims to be a popularis consul, a consul who's speaking for the populace.
Valentina Arona, can we can we develop that? His manoeuvring is very good. His political with a small P and a big P seems to be very good. But did he, at that early stage, early-ish in his career as we know it, embody ideals which appealed to people? Because in his later essays, and that he certainly did. Was he at that stage thought of as a man of ideals, a man of vision?
Yes, certainly by 63, he was a man of vision. But mainly his vision at that stage was the one that of the what he calls the Concordia Ordinum, so the concord, the harmony amongst the members of the elite. So what he claims in that his great achievement in having suppressed the Catalan conspiracy was very much to have united behind him the elite. And for him, that was perhaps the most important achievement in terms of the world of ideas. There was, if you think about Concordia, is cum cors, so is a cors, the heart, that moves in the same direction, as if, you know, the members of the elite feel in the same way, they move in the same direction for the well-being of the community, for the common good. But of course, it doesn't last long, as Catherine has already.
No, but he did capture them, and they were a small elite, and he was not part of them. And the one thing he lacked was always not being part of the, in a big sense, the political family in Rome. And he got them on his side there.
Yeah, he was, and he wasn't, in the sense that he was an equestrian. So he that meant, in essence, by the late Republic, that his family had was of substantial wealth, and the equites by the late Republic did play a key political role as well, alongside the senators. So throughout his life, he does battle consistently the being the new man, to be the outsider, the one who doesn't have a consular ancestor in his family, you know, in his background. But he is a consul. He has become a consul himself at that stage. And he is one of the equites, and therefore, for he thinks, and he does make sure that we don't forget it, that he now has made it. And not only has made it, he's made it big time, as Catherine said.
But also, as Catherine alluded to, we must place this now, after a short time, his very victory turned against him, because he had sent these people, sentenced these Roman citizens to death without judging them, and this was considered in itself to be a terrible thing to do, and the elite, a lot of the elite, turned against him for that.
Yes, yes, it did. Putting the Catalan conspirators to trial, to death without trial, what he did, he violated one of the essential civic rights of Roman citizens, and that was the right to provocatio, so the right to trial. By doing so, what he did was violating one of the liberties of the Roman people, and that could not be considered acceptable within a republican framework. Therefore, by the time he and the mood, the political mood, because of that, turned against him quite straight away. At the end of his consulship already, he was not allowed to in his final speech, when when he lay down the office, he was not allowed to carry out the full speech, where he could therefore, you know, boast of his activities. And it didn't take long for his arch enemy Claudius to pass a law according to which those who had killed Roman citizens without trial should go on exile.
And he went on exile? And
yes, he actually prevented it in a way. As soon as the first law was passed, he went on voluntary exile. As soon as he left Rome, a second law was passed, and this time around the law had his name on it. So to a certain extent there are some degree of there is a certain degree of questions about the legality of this, because that was a privilegium, so an ad nominem law. But regardless, he was already in exile, and he clearly, this time around at least, he had to say right, in a sense, that Claudius was surely after him for that. And the result was that, because he was therefore presented as the tyrant, because he had violated one of Roman liberties, and therefore he had his house was razed to the ground, his properties was confiscated, and what was perhaps most astonishing, Claudius built on the grounds of his house and the foundation a temple to the goddess Liberty. It may not have been a temple, it may be an edicula, but...
Melissa, who was this Claudius who was such an enemy of Cicero?
The irony was that he had been a younger man whom Cicero had befriended in earlier years, and then at a certain point there was a political parting of the ways. Claudius was someone who flirted with violating and ultimately transgressively violated Roman civic norms. So the nadir of his career was being found out to have dressed up in women's clothing and insinuated himself into the inner sanctum where religious rites were being practiced that only women were supposed to witness. But at this moment, he's quite popular in the city. He has a lot of following among the plebeians, and he's able to wield that power against Cicero.
What did Cicero do in exile, and how did he organize his return? What did he do, first of all?
He moaned quite a lot. He wrote letters to lots of people trying to figure out what he might do and whether he might be able to go. So he went off to Asia Minor and actually had quite a lot of difficulty at the beginning finding anyone who was even willing to receive him, because it was thought to be, you know, a difficult thing to do. Ultimately, he is able to come back, and even some years later holds another governorship of a province, so he doesn't, you know, he's able to come back for a certain period into the fold.
Has he begun writing his essays and reflections at this stage?
Not quite. Not quite yet, it's not the major period of his literary production. That comes a few years later, once he's returned to Rome, but then found himself in more political difficulties and ends up spending quite a lot of time outside the city itself on one of his estates, and that's the first major period of his writing.
Catherine Steele, so he comes back and there's turbulence in it. Can you just describe the state of Rome, the state of of Rome and the Republic?
Well, turbulence indeed. A number of factors are coming together. Claudius has been slightly eclipsed. He's no longer holding the office of Tribunate of the Plebs, which gave him the legal authority to challenge Cicero back in 58. But the popular politics that he's espousing, he still has support. He's looking to rise up the cursus himself, hold the praetorship, eventually hold the consulship, though that never happens. At the same time, there is the military power translating into political power of Pompey and Caesar. And effectively, Pompey and Caesar had joined forces in 59 in order to support their mutual interests. And that relationship had got a bit rocky. And that the relationship is getting a bit rocky at precisely the time that Cicero returns in 57. So initially he thinks, aha, I can resume my position of authority guiding the Res Publica. But in the spring of 56, after a period of about 8 months in which Cicero is very active and is very much trying to be an independent politician, getting his house back, quite apart from anything else, Caesar and Pompey patch it up. And that's the point at which they say to Cicero, look, back off. you do what we tell you, or you're not going to do anything. And that's the point at which he very reluctantly acknowledges that perhaps his service to the Res Publica has to take a different form, and he starts writing the great political treatises of the mid-50s.
Can we begin on those great treatises, Valentina? There are several of them, and we won't have time to do all of them by any means. What is he basically trying to do in his writing about the Republic, about rhetoric, about public office, and so on?
Well, of course, he's trying to do different things in the text. However, overall, he certainly tried to find a kind of a recipe to restore a republic that might even never have existed in such a wonderful state that has this mixed and balanced constitution that he thinks at some point Rome embodied in the 5th century BC. But as far as we know as historians, the only record we have comes from very late sources. So, was certainly part of the Roman intellectual tradition more than perhaps the reality of things.
So what was it? What was this mixture he was going back to and said this had happened once and we can make it happen again? What was it?
So it was a balanced form of constitution mixed of three main elements. There was a monarchical element represented by the consul and an aristocratic element that was represented by the Senate and a democratic element that was represented by the popular assemblies. To be precise, actually, Cicero, rather than talking about institutions to which he refers, he also talks about political ideals. So he's actually a mixed and balanced constitution between auctoritas, so authority of the Senate, the potestas, the power of the magistrates, and the liberty of the people. And when these three elements, these three different components, find an harmonious way of cooperating with each other, then the republic could function properly.
Did he think he was putting forward a viable prescription, something that was practical that they would listen to and try to put into practice?
Now, when he's thinking and writing about the Republic in this specific case, and as well as the Legibus, we are in the late 50s, so 54, the Republica was finished in 51, and it's very much the world that Catherine has described. So Rome was really a mess, was completely chaotic. In 52, even we have Pompey that was elected consul sine collega, so sole consul. So, a republic that has been based on this idea of the power sharing element was no longer there.
So this is partly to do with the generals themselves becoming very powerful. The empire's expanded a great deal. They're coming back with great loot and soldiers who are loyal to them rather than to the republic, and that has tipped the balance quite strongly.
Yeah, you certainly have a big the army itself played a huge role, but we should not underestimate also the social and economic changes that happened throughout the republic.
Sorry, you want to come in?
Well, I think one of the things that's always striking about the relationship between general and army, at least with Caesar, is that Caesar at least seems to have articulated the claim to follow him in terms of the army's own liberty.
Yes.
So we have generals who are certainly interested in the personal power they can gain by their relationship with the army, but that relationship always seems to be articulated in terms of the res publica rather than the naked ambition. It always needs to be dressed up in language which fits with the interests of the army.
But you're talking about it being dressed up or real?
I think in the case of Caesar it's probably dressed up, but nonetheless he needed to articulate those claims in the language of popular liberty. How far he genuinely thought that that was an element that had been underplayed, I think, is a really interesting question, because he certainly, when he comes back to Rome in 49, he's doing it on the basis that an elite in Rome has hijacked the debate and are not listening to what the community as a whole wants, which is to give honour to Caesar.
Yeah.
So can we go into this constitutional conflict between the ideal and the real, Melissa? Can you just develop that a bit more?
Yeah, so one of the major tensions in the decades before Cicero's playing a key role, and then during that time, is between the Senate and the consuls on the one hand, and then the tribunes of the other. So it was mentioned that Clodius was a tribune. The tribunes were elected directly by the people, and they had the power to defend the people, to veto any decision of the consul, to propose laws which would speak on behalf of the people. And that tension between popular power, especially as instantiated in that form, so the Gracchi, for example, in the previous century had used their power as tribunes to try to affect a kind of land redistribution, and this was remembered as by Cicero and his allies as one of the great moment of peril of the Republic earlier, which had only been solved in one case by the murder of one of its proponents. And this is actually something to which Cicero returned again and again in his political writings, that moment.
Is there a sense all around, not only in Cicero, that the Republic is shaky and is even shaking, and it has to be not only defended and shored up, but some way found to perpetuate it?
Yeah, and I think what's so interesting to me about Cicero in this moment is that he still really believes in the norms that have governed the Republic, the traditions and the mores that are associated with the offices, and then one after the other, they're falling, so they're being violated. So one example is Caesar, actually, at a relatively young age and with a lot of bad reputation, standing to be the Pontifex Maximus, the chief priest of the Republic, which would normally have been a sort of ancient, august man of unimpeachable reputation, and Caesar thinks, well, I can stand for that. Why not? You know, and that's an example of the...
Why was he unsuitable?
Well, because he was known to be a womanizer, an adulterer, probably, too. He was very... he was a brilliant man and in many ways very interesting figure, but was
not
young.
A priest, really.
Yeah, not really a priest. Yeah. No, perhaps. No.
Let's cut to the chase there. Okay. Can we go back to the people now, Catherine? What was his view of the people, really, Cicero's view? Because in a sense he was nearer the people than the elite were, you could say, perhaps, on the scale of things.
I'm not sure about that. I think his background economically and socially, he's aligned with the elite. It's the broader elite rather than that bit of it that stood previously for political office. So his view of the people, I mean, I think there's a problem for him, because on the one hand, within the mixed constitution to which he is entirely wedded as a form, the people have an essential role. In on the Republic, he articulates this as res publica, res populi. The res publica belongs to the people. And this fundamental authorising capacity of the people in electing offices and in passing legislation is fundamental to the Republic. So on the one hand, he accepts and embraces that role and acknowledges that in a state that is governed by justice, there needs to be an element of equality, which is represented by the role that the people play. However, his own lived experience of Roman politics showed him very clearly that the people could do all sorts of things that he didn't like. Sent him into exile. and a whole range of other things, obviously.
That's a good response, but I'd like another one, which is not just to do with him.
You mean in terms of what...
Well, you said that there's a whole lot of things that he didn't like. Send him in exile and pine. That's just about him. But other things he didn't like as regards to the way they appeared in the state.
Well, I think it's the popular trend within politics, which particularly is concerned often with economic measures expressed in legislation. So land redistribution,
They wanted land redistribution.
Yes, land redistribution, and he didn't.
Yeah.
Because it's a challenge to property rights, and because it's the spending of the state's resources on things which perhaps it shouldn't. So there are those tensions, and he tries to resolve them. In his oratory, he resolves it by saying that the people who voted aren't the real people. So they're an urban mob, they're a rabble, they've been misled. But in the political treatises, there's the theoretical results which we've had in the Republic, but there's also the pragmatic sense of how do you give the people enough power that they will be satisfied. So in On the Laws, there's a rather odd and disturbing passage where he talks about voting systems and the tribunate of the plebs being enough to create the species libertatis, the appearance of freedom. So he struggles with this tension between the ideal and what he actually saw in practice.
But what we've got, Valentina, coming close to, maybe this is just hindsight, we've got the shadow of tyranny, the foreboding of the end of the great ideal of the Republic, however often it was observed in the breach, it doesn't matter, there it had gone, and going in another direction in the terrible, terrible path of tyranny, which the Republic was deeply opposed to. Did Cicero sense this? What was he doing about it, given that he might have sensed it?
He certainly, throughout, from the time he comes back from exile onwards, he keeps lamenting that the Republic is not there. Is no longer there. We might have, you know, we keep the name of the Republic, but the true Republic is not there. It's like a painting whose colors are now fading away. However, somehow he has the gift to side always with the wrong people.
But is this, can I just pause for a second, if I may, just to be clear. Is this because people like Caesar and Pompey are behaving in a way which he sees as tyrannical and therefore dangerous?
Oh, yes, no, of course. So he supports Pompey against Caesar because he saw in Caesar the tyrant, and you know, he rejoices at the murder, the assassination of Caesar. He actually laments that he has not been invited to take
to join in. Yeah.
Yes, and that they actually, it seems, you know, that I would just also say that he was left out because he was renowned to be too nervous, and you know, going on with age, so it was not the case to have him around at that stage. So, but he was extremely pleased that the tyrant was killed, and he justifies it by saying that the tyrant, so a Roman citizen who behaves tyrannically, renounces himself to his citizenship. What he does, he severs any links with human fellowships, mm-hmm. and therefore is like a limb of a body that no longer has blood circulating in it. So what we do, we amputate it. And therefore, this is what we have to do with a tyrant. He has to be eliminated.
It justifies tyrant by saying once he stepped out of the community, he's no longer in the community.
Yes,
that
no
he
one
mustn't be treated as one of the community.
Excellent.
Melissa, Mr. Lane, he explores the difference between honour and personal advantage. We've got to try in some way to intervene that the writings is doing, which are influential for what still are 2,000 years. What does he argue there?
So this is in his last great work, The Deificis, which he's writing in the very last year of his life, just about at the moment when he's about to stand up against Mark Antony, which will ultimately lead to his death. And this is his final attempt to reconcile the ideals of the Republic. And the idea is that honor, which includes the moral virtues, the social virtues, such as justice, liberality, magnanimity, decorum, when properly understood, does not come into conflict with one's personal advantage. So it's the old great Greek Platonic question, what should I act for my own advantage even if it involves me in doing injustice? And Cicero structures the Deificis with book one is about honor, book two is about advantage, and book three is about the seeming conflicts, only to show us that none of the seeming conflicts are real. And two of the best examples, one is tyrannicide, which he reconciles by saying it's not murder because you're saving the community from this gangrenous limb. But the other great example, there are some wonderful, much more practical examples. So he has an example of if you're selling a house, is it honorable to conceal the faults in the house when you want to have a buyer? And he ultimately argues if you're deliberately silent so as to conceal the faults, you are yourself violating these duties of human fellowship, and so you would be behaving dishonorably, but it would also not be to your advantage because you would be violating human fellowship. So therefore, he's always able to show that the honorable and the advantageous coincide.
Catherine, before we move to more action, he wrote a lot about the orator. One of his great essays was about being an orator and oration and so on. What were his priorities there? And he made his name, as you said earlier in the program, this great defense attack on Verres, the Sicilian who had cheated his country so much. What were his priorities, he Cicero put out, for oratory? And why was it so important for him?
Oratory theoretically mattered for him within the context of the res publica because it's what enables the right decisions to be made. He accepts that rational argument on its own isn't going to be enough in situations where large numbers of people are reaching a decision. So you need to have rational argument and then you need to persuade people to do it. So it's this practical response. And we can see that right back in his...
So he regards democracy as a political act? I mean, oratory is a political act.
Oh, absolutely. And in his very first published work, which is otherwise a not hugely interesting rhetorical handbook, I mean, you may pick me up on that, but it does nonetheless have a really interesting introduction in which the young Cicero says, oratory is fundamental to human society. That's what creates human society. We can't come together and live together and enjoy all the benefits until we have somebody who can speak and persuade us to do that. Otherwise, we're all in a state of bestial nature. And that thread, I think, goes through. He articulates it. It becomes much more nuanced and exciting as a model of the good life and the skills that the orator needs to have. But that's the basic theoretical point. Oratory helps communities function. In fact, it's essential for communities to function.
And again, he's going back to Greece with Demosthenes, isn't he?
Very much so. And his oratorical theory, as he develops it, is very much looking back to more philosophically informed oratory as opposed to the rather mechanical rhetorical treatises and handbooks that seemed to be quite dominant in rhetorical education at Rome at this time. But there's also the personal side to this. Cicero was not a soldier, and therefore he didn't have access to all the power and the glory and the reputation-enhancing excitement of military victory. So he sets up oratory as the civilian alternative by which you can serve and indeed save the state.
Thank you. Valentina, what risk was Cicero facing in 43 BC?
Death.
Yeah, that's the start. Is that the beginning and the end, or can we develop it a little bit? Can we push up the fine execution for a moment or two?
So yet again, he chose the wrong side. So what happened in 44-43, he thought that the new enemy that should be really eliminated was Mark Antony.
Why is that?
Because he saw the direct link, which actually was also there, between Caesar, a direct link between Caesar and Mark Antony. So he thought that Mark Antony wanted to become the next tyrant. And he found in Octavian, who then is going to become Augustus.
Yeah, Octavian is Caesar's adopted son, is 19 at the time.
Yes, and he found in him is a potential antidote. And he thought, therefore, that he could supporting Octavian and pushing the Senate to act against Antony, he might have created some action to eliminate the new threat.
Did he think, you're going to take me wrong, did he think that great speech of Mark Antony, in a sense, saying that Caesar was not a tyrant, those who, as it were, did for him were tyrants, and what Caesar did was honourable and fine, and basically he was going to go and do that. Do you think that he thought that?
I very much doubt it. Throughout Cicero's life, you see him at some stage supporting a line of argument which, you know, in 10 years later, he might reject completely. So, you know, in the 60s, he's in favour of extraordinary powers given to Pompey. In 44-43, that is absolutely the end of the Republic. And therefore, from this point of view, it's... He's a good politician in the sense of, you know, he works on the basis of expediency. So in terms of for Octavian, in the letters, he's clearly he has doubts about Octavian. He thinks he's too young. He's politically naive. Yes.
Yeah. So why did he go try to woo him and against Mark Antony?
I think he thought that he was the least of the two evils.
No.
And by then he got it wrong. And therefore, when in 43 the so-called Second Triumvirate is created by the Lex Titia, so what happens is that therefore the first act that Mark Antony, Octavian and Lepidus carry out are proscribing Cicero.
But before that, Cicero had let out a yell of invective against Mark Antony.
He yes.
Not only backed the wrong horse, but...
attacked the wrong enemy.
That's right.
Very much so. And even...
Did he attack him on grounds... invective is a word used. Did he attack him on grounds which were consonant with his philosophy? I.e. beware
the
tyrant.
I see what you mean. Yes and no, yet again. So invective was an essential part of rhetoric and political life. And, you know, so invective was mainly personal. So invective was also about the way you looked, your sexual taste, habits, desire for food, and he was so. And Antony has all the traits of excessiveness of a tyrant. So it's all part of the same picture.
Is that slightly out of character? Is Cicero going off the scale here, Melissa?
Well, it's interesting. I think he realizes that it's his last great act of political life.
Yeah,
and
he actually
says in one of the Philippics, "I have laid the basis for a new constitution." So I think he sees it as the last throw of the dice to try to rid the Republic of this new tyrant and thereby refound the Roman constitution, although he knows that it's very unlikely to succeed.
Did he know the danger he was in, or was it? Did he think that he was going to get away with it, and he and Octavian were going to live happily ever after and start the Republic again?
Well, I think until Octavian makes the common cause with Antony and Lepidus, he may have that fantasy. But at the moment that that happens, he knows he's done for. One of the interesting things, of course, is that many of his allies at that point had committed suicide. Cato, as a Stoic, had committed suicide when the battle against Caesar was a crucial battle, had been lost. And it's interesting that Cicero never really seems to have considered that path. I mean, he is not a Stoic. He, I think, ultimately does recognize that death is a kind of evil, although he debates that question with himself and some of his other writings. So he's willing to suffer death bravely, but he doesn't take that act of suicide.
But as soon as that comes out, Mark Antony is after him, and Cicero escapes to one of his houses, and they find him, and they slaughter him.
Yes.
How efficient, how was that done, the slaughtering?
Knives.
No, but what was left of him?
Well, the stories are that his head and his hands were cut off, and they were taken to Rome, and Fulvia, who was Antony's wife but had been previously married to Clodius, pinned them up on the speaker's platform.
Right.
And that the hand mattered because it was the hand that had written the Philippic.
The Philippic being the diatribe against
Antony. And she stuck a hairpin through his tongue.
As it happens to his time. I think that's enough for the present. I think we can move on now to, very briefly, I'm sorry to spring this in. What do you think his legacy was? I mean, I was reading him at school in the 20th century. I'm sure people are in the 21st century. So his legacy has gone on for a long time.
Yes, for sure. Well, perhaps there are, I would say, three main areas. His language, as you said, people are still reading Cicero and learning, laughing through his text. We read Cicero as an historical source, if you want to know about the history of the late Republic. But we also read Cicero as a political thinker. He has not only influenced a number of political thinkers throughout the centuries, but even nowadays with a renaissance of republicanism and neo-republicanism, the idea of Cicero and how a republic should be governed is very much upfront in our thinking.
Very, Melissa.
He also translated Greek philosophy into Latin and left us with an enriched vocabulary for what it is to think philosophically.
He's a wonderful writer, and almost whatever you're interested in about how to be a civilized human in society, you can find something interesting in him.
Yes, because his essays cover a wide range. We've only
old age, friendship, a whole range of more technical philosophical Greek treatises, and we haven't even started talking about the letters.
That will have to be another time. Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Catherine Steele, Miss Elaine, Valentina Arena. Next week we'll be discussing the world of cephalopods, the octopus, squid, cuttlefish and nautilus. Thanks for listening.
And the In Our Time podcast gets some extra time now with a few minutes of bonus material from Melvin and his guests.
Right, now you're back on again. Do you think we got to the heart of what we set out to do?
I think we did. But when I was thinking about this programme and drawing it, it seemed to me that it's interesting that when we talk about Cicero's political philosophy, one thing we never even touch on is slavery. And it does seem to me extraordinary that we can talk about political philosophy within a society that's based on slavery. And is that because Cicero just never talks about it? That's my sense. It's just not a problem for him. Or however much he's interested in Libertas.
Mm-hmm.
Now, why is that? Because it's not that the Romans have a total blind spot on this. Look at Seneca.
Yeah, you're right. He doesn't mention that. He does, however, consider the liberti, so the freedmen, as a political entity, because one thing I think we have missed out is actually the processio. So what happens just before the De Republica, so the great political treaty, when he writes this speech in defense of Cestius, halfway through the speech he almost forgets the case of the legal case, and he embarks in a redefinition of the political entities, the political players of Rome. And in doing so, when he claims the optimates
include
not only, you know, the members of the elite, the senators, the equites, but also people from the municipal towns, of course, like him. But even the liberti, so what he's talking about, even ex-slaves. Mm-hmm. So we, contrary to Greece, we are talking about a society that allows a slave to become a citizen, and actually not only then to be entitled to vote, but even according to this redefinition, to be considered an optimates, so around a political active player, around whose consensus it becomes essential, from his point of view, to rebuilding a res publica around the Senate.
Yes, I think that's right, and I think one of the things that we could have looked at in more detail is this question of language to re-describe the different entities within the state. So this massive broadening of what elite means that he does in Processio, because he's so keen to create a consensus of everybody who isn't Clodius and his followers.
Yes.
And kind of restrict Clodius and his followers into a small gap. We didn't talk about hostis. The way that and it's Cicero isn't the first person to do this, the way that the Roman elite uses the word hostis, an external enemy, to somehow solve internal crisis by expelling the offending members from the state, and thus sidestepping the whole legal problem of how do you execute whatever your own citizens. If you call them hostes, you kind of solve the problem. And I think there's a link there between the way that you can, that Cicero can then say that the tyrant is not part of the state.
Yes.
I think the other point about slavery, to go back to that, is that in the De Legibus, the idea of the multiple layers of law, so we have natural law, but then we have the jus gentium, the law of all the nations, and then we have the civil law of a nation like Rome. And so I think he's very willing to accept that the customs on the whole, the legal customs and traditions and institutions of Rome, have a kind of validity and standing, and so he's not going to question something like slavery, which is part of those traditions.
What do you think he could have done to save himself at the end?
I don't think he wanted to.
Had he merely not...
I don't think he wanted to.
That's what I'm trying to get at. That act he did. Did he know? I mean, he must have known.
Yeah, he must
have known. Wouldn't that be a foolhardiness? Or?
Well, I think in a sense, you know, as Valentina said already, for many years he had thought that the republic that he had lived in was dead. All the great figures that of his kind of youth and early career, most of them were dead by this stage.
You mentioned Cato. Who else was dead?
Well, by this time, Caesar is dead. Yeah. You know, Brutus, is a little bit later after Cicero. But, you know, the sort of great figures of the age have mostly fallen. Pompey, Crassus, obviously. And so, in a sense, I think, you know, in a sense, he has nothing else to play for, and he wants to go down fighting, and he makes that choice. And I think, as Valentina said, one of the really striking things is he was, in some ways, a good judge of principles, but a terrible judge of character. Mm. And I think because he couldn't understand people whose ambition was not just to be first among equals, as his was, but to really break with equality altogether. So men like Caesar and Antony and Octavian, that driving ambition that led them to destroy the forms of the republic that in some way maintained equality, he could just never understand that. He thought he could control them. He thought it wasn't real, and then he was wrong every time.
And there's a sense, too, that... I mean, if we want to personalise this in terms of what kind of a person Cicero was, there is that sense that he was always being called back to a sense of a personal ideal. That letter at the end of 60, when he's been asked to join Caesar and Pompey in this, you know, this informal compact that they're going to run Rome with, he's asked to join and he refuses, and he quotes Homer at that point, and it's a personal line he can't step over. It's not consonant with his own self-conception, and so he's not able to join Caesar in 49, although at some level I think he knows that prudentially that might be the thing to do. Mm-hmm. Because of what Caesar stands for in breaking the republic rather than trying to operate within it in some way, though, as Pompey did. Though, I mean, the other thing about it is he had no illusions about Pompey either. I mean, he's quite clear that had Pompey won, there would have been
so these
prescriptions.
So these generals were were in really sort. Well, I know producers trying banging on the door, trying to get in to break up this little republic. But basically, in one way, you could say that the might of these military generals was the biggest distorting factor.
I think so, and the failure to find a way of controlling it. I mean, it had always been a destabilising factor, but the Senate had always somehow managed to keep it in check.
Well, here's the producer with news for us all.
Only the offer of tea and coffee.
Pretty good.
Coffee, please. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Me too, thank you.
Can we come back and do the cuttlefish?
In Our Time with Melvyn Bragg is produced by Simon Tillotson.
Hi, I'm Rhianna Dillon, and I just wanted to let you know about another podcast that I think you might like. It's called Seriously, and twice a week we bring you incredible documentaries from BBC Radio 4. We like to say they're seriously interesting stories told a little sideways. From politics to fashion, arts to current affairs, I'm sure there will be something that takes your fancy. So join me there. Just search for Seriously in your favourite podcast app.